Good morning, brethren and sisters, and loving greetings from the Austin Ecclesia, many of us that are here this weekend to attend. So this is the second group of 2,000 years, and as it covered Abraham, David, and the kingdom of God, but that's just on the surface. This is going to be a difficult one, and I understand from some of the jokes I've been hearing earlier today, it's like the first talk only went up to the first few chapters of Genesis, and I've got the rest. And I have to tell you, it's like 1 hour is not enough to do justice to the rest of the Old Testament. I'm going to try my hardest, though. But I have to say, there are so many important things that happened along the way. So many things that we've broken down and given a lecture by themselves. So I'm going to be somewhere between too detailed and not detailed enough as the time goes on. Apologies for that, but let's get started. So from what I understand, last night's lecture ended with the Tower of Babel. After the flood had wiped humanity clean, after Noah and his family started things over again, people again began to fall away from God. And once again, they wanted to be like the gods. They wanted to build a tower that could go up to gods. They wanted to stay together instead of following the concept, being fruitful and multiply, and filling the entire earth. So God had to forcibly make them go forth and settle by the confounding of languages. Now, unfortunately, scattered about, they would forget about God, and attribute the things that had happened to their own idols, and the stories that they would make up would take place regarding the gods that they worshipped, although with many of the older cultures, you'll notice a similarity from story to story. They all came from the same place, but written in human minds to go with the gods that a particular culture would follow. One such culture was the city of Ur, which is on the Euphrates River as it comes into what's now called the Gulf of Persia. And in the city was a man named Abram. And in him God saw something special and decided that this man, Abram, was going to be the one to whom he was going to give specific promises, a specific land, because he says this man wanted to know him, wanted to follow him, wanted to worship him. So for the faith that this man wanted to develop, God was going to reward him. So he gave him certain promises, the promise especially of a land of his own, what we call the land of Canaan today. Promise that Abraham would possess this forever. And he said another interesting thing in the promise that will become important as time goes on, in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So this is talking specifically about him, but also indicating that his promise was going to somehow bless all the nations around him in the world as well. It goes into the fact that eventually what were called the Gentile nations, anyone who was not of the Hebrews, would be blessed by understanding the ties to Abraham. So it's important for us especially to know this. So Abraham sets off. He's going with his wife, Sarai. His nephew Lot is with them as well. There was an unfortunate stop in Egypt when Abraham called Sarah his sister, and Pharaoh was plagued because he thought he would take Sarah for himself. So they returned to Canaan. And unfortunately, Abraham's men and Lot's men started fighting because they were so rich, their possessions were clashing. They had to go their separate ways. Lot went towards the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, which turned out to be unfortunate because those cities were wicked. Abraham took the rest. But God promised him that if he looked at all four points of the compass, the land he saw would be his forever. So he was to journey through this land to understand it and to get the feel of it. Now Abraham was very old and Sarah became old as well. And the unfortunate thing is, even though God promises something, sometimes human hands try to speed things along, try to help God out. Sarah thought it would be a great idea, for example, to give her handmaid Hagar to Abraham so that a child might come from him. A child did come from him, Ishmael. But this caused problems because eventually the child of promise, Isaac, would come along. Ishmael would mock him. Sarah wants Hagar and Ishmael thrown out. They do get thrown out. They go their separate ways. From Ishmael comes the Arab people. And the interesting thing is, There is bad blood between the Arabs and the Hebrews unto this day. And as we see similar examples as we go through here, there's more bad blood that's going to be added. But this is where it starts. The seed of Ishmael will become one of the Hebrews' many foes. And as for Lot, God had determined that the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah were too wicked to stand, and warned Lot to flee. And he did, with his wife and his two daughters. Unfortunately, the wife disobeyed a command of the angels to not look back on what was going to happen to the cities, and she died, as we know, becoming a pillar of salt as this volcanic cataclysm came down upon the cities and destroyed them. As for Lot, he ended up essentially being a hermit in the mountains, and his daughters, through unwise decisions, wanting to preserve the seed, much like Sarah wanted to do with Abraham, by their father, preserved seed. From this came the children of Moab and Ammon, who also became foes to the Hebrews. Let's turn our attention to Isaac then, the child of promise. As Abraham was growing old, he was concerned that Isaac would take one of the people of the land who did not have an understanding of who God was. Now granted, Abraham's family was idolatrous, but they grew to understand who Abraham's God was and how powerful he was as well. So he sent a servant back to his own people saying, "Can you find a wife for my son? I don't want my son to take a wife of the unbelievers in this land." And this is how Rebekah came about. And the promises were extended to Isaac. He was told not to make the same mistake of his father of going into Egypt during a time of famine. "Wait here, the promises will come. I will take care of you." So Rebekah was barren at first, but God's blessing, she bore two sons, Esau and Jacob. Now, God in prophecy had told her, when she was wondering why the children struggled in her womb, it's because these children in life would struggle with each other. But the elder, which turned out to be Esau, would serve the younger, which turned out to be Jacob. Now, as I said, God has a plan. God sees a plan carried out, but humans like to put their fingers into it and make it happen. Well, Jacob's name means heel grabber, supplanter. He was deceptive. He did some very sneaky things. And both of these involved food, by the way. Esau came back from a hunt. He was famished, he was weary, and Jacob thought it would be a great idea to sell him a pottage of lentils for his birthright. Esau didn't think anything about it at the time. But when Isaac grew older and wanted to give Esau the familial blessing, told him to go out, hunt, get some savory meat, cook it, come back, cook it for me, and before I die, I will bless you. Esau did that, but Rebekah tried to help the promises along by telling Jacob to bring a kid goat from the flock, get some of Esau's raiments, and by the way, since you're a smooth man and Esau's hairy, we'll put the animal skins on your arms, and you'll have to sound like Esau the best you can. So Jacob did trick his father and received the blessing. Esau missed out, wailed and cried trying to get some sort of blessing, wasn't happy with the one he got, determined he was going to kill Jacob. So Jacob, for his part in this, had to flee, had to go into exile to Padan Aram. This is where Abraham's family was from. And this thing is deception would continue to follow him. Because when he returned and found his uncle Laban, he had two daughters, Rachel and Leah, and he really, really favored Rachel. He wanted to marry Rachel. Promised to work 7 years for her. But Laban, knowing a custom that the elder child was supposed to get married for the younger child, tricked Jacob into marrying Leah. And when the trick was discovered, he then told Jacob, "You could have Rachel as well, but you're going to have to serve another 7 years." So this is the first deception that came back upon Jacob. And of course, having Rachel and Leah, and Leah having the chance to give children, and Rachel made barren by God because of the disfavor and the unfairness shown to Leah, they would feud amongst each other. And then they would take their handmaids, give them to Jacob, and say, "Hey, have children by these." So Jacob ends up with a much larger family than I think anyone would expect at this time. Feuding wives, Laban not settling on a perfect wage for him, And so finally, he has to leave. He and his family all leave, and they're going to head back to the land where Isaac was. But the interesting thing about it is along the way he met with Esau. They're able to reconcile a little bit. But Esau would go on towards Mount Seir. Jacob would go on toward the land. Esau, because of the redness of his hair and the redness of the lentils he gave up his birthright for, would be called Edom. And the Edomites would yet become another foe for Israel. But Jacob would return, and of his 12 sons, there was one particular called Joseph. And Joseph had prophetic dreams. God would give him these prophetic dreams, and they were ones indicating that his family would be giving obeisance to him and respect as if he was some sort of ruler. It didn't help matters already that the other brothers were jealous of the attention Jacob gave Joseph, but to hear these dreams was too much for them. And so at one point, they sold him into slavery, and he was taken by these slave drivers into Egypt. They made up a story to Jacob saying how an animal had killed him. So Jacob was at a loss and depressed. And during this time, though, while Joseph was in Egypt, at first he was a slave, a very good slave, a very proper slave, a very loyal slave, until some hearsay ended up dropping him in prison. And in prison, he was a very good prisoner, a very loyal prisoner, and he became a chief of prisoners. But eventually, though, the dreams happened not to Joseph, but to the Pharaoh of Egypt, who dreamed of good things happening and bad things overrunning the good, but the bad things didn't become good themselves. There were skinny cattle eating fat cattle, thin wheat consuming good wheat. Joseph was able to interpret this dream, that after 7 years of great harvest would become 7 years of terrible famine, and something had to be done to get ready for this. Because Joseph was empowered by God to tell what the future would be, Pharaoh took him out of that prison and promoted him to power to direct the feeding of the land of Egypt. It wasn't just Egypt was affected by the famine, it was the surrounding lands as well, including where Jacob and his family were. And so the brothers would come to Egypt to buy food, and after some time, for Joseph put them through many tests, eventually he revealed he was Joseph. And graciously, not only forgave them for what they had done, but invited them to come to the land because he did not want them or his father, did not want any of them to perish because of this famine. And that is how the family of what would be called the Israelites came into Egypt. But unfortunately, after Joseph died and that particular Pharaoh died, there was a change in power. This Pharaoh did not understand who Joseph was, did not care what the previous Pharaoh had done, saw these children of Israel were a threat to them. So he put them in an oppressive work environment. And because they were still multiplying and populating the land of Goshen that had been given to them, he made a ruling that the male child would be cast into the river to die. Moses was born at this time. He was hidden at birth for as long as possible. And eventually, as some of us know the story, put in a basket of reeds. Pharaoh's own daughter found him and adopted him, and he grew up in Pharaoh's house. But eventually he understood his roots, tried to help. One slave was being beaten by an Egyptian by killing that Egyptian, and then he had to go into exile himself to the land of Midian. He was there for a long time. He was married. He was a shepherd for the man Jethro. But God called him back in a vision of the burning bush. He told him he needs to go back. He would be the one to free Israel from their bondage and bring them out to the land as promised. So he did return, and empowered by God through the sign of 10 plagues, showed Pharaoh that all the gods of Egypt could not stand against the God of Israel. And after the last terrible plague in which the firstborn children across the land died, they were finally let go. So this is called the Exodus, where the children of Israel left Egypt and went into the wilderness to make their way to the land. And there was one more thing. Egypt tried to change their mind about letting the slaves go when they got to the Red Sea. But through God's providence, the sea was open. Israel came through. It closed upon the Egyptians right afterwards. And you would think with such a miraculous thing, the people would be as obedient as they could to God. But human nature being what they are, they would complain. And God would take care of them by giving them water and manna. He brought them to Mount Sinai where the law was given. They stumbled there, though, by making a golden calf because Moses could spend a considerable time up in the mountain receiving this law. When they finally moved on from there and came to the land that was promised, they were scared of the inhabitants and wanted to go back to Egypt. And so for punishment, God told them, for the 40 days you search this land, you're going to spend 40 years in the wilderness until this sinful generation dies off. And there was many more rebellions that happened along the way. Some of the priests tried to become high priests, were consumed. Other rebels were consumed by the earth closing upon them. A plague struck when the people blamed Moses for these happenings. And with another complaining for water, Moses was so upset, he asked if he alone had to get the water out of the rock. And so Moses lost the chance to take the children of Israel into the land promised to them. So as he grew old and they kind of came up to the Jordan at the end of these 40 years, it was time to pass the mantle onto one of the two faithful men who had not died out of those spies. Those were Joshua and Caleb. Joshua in particular had been Moses' right-hand man. And so as Moses went up to Mount Nebo to finally lay down to rest, Joshua assumed control for the invasion of the land about to begin. And God appeared to him and he told him, "Be strong and of good courage. I will not fail thee nor forsake thee. The land is yours. Take it." So they took Jericho. You may have heard the story about how they would march around the city for 7 days. On the last day, march around the city 7 times. With a loud cry, God called forth the quake to just make the city collapse on itself. The walls collapsed. They went in and conquered. Ai had a slight trouble because someone had stolen something from Jericho, and they needed to punish the thief before they could take Ai, which they did as well. But they made another mistake by making peace with the people of Gibeon, who claimed to be ambassadors from a far country. And so, realizing that mistake, they decided that these people would have to become their slaves then. But they had made a promise by God not to kill them. When you make a promise by the name of God, you were expected to keep it. Eventually, the entire land is conquered, and so much to gloss over. So much to gloss over. It all falls under their hands. Joshua, reaching the end of his life, tells the children of Israel to stay steadfast to their God once he and the elders around him had moved on. They had promised. But when Joshua passed and the elders passed, this is not what happened. The next stretch of several hundred years was one of idolatry. They would fall to the idols of the lands for the people that they did not cast out. Because they didn't completely remove these people, this caused culture contamination. They would learn of the gods of these people, be interested in the gods of these people, and grew to worship the gods of these people. God would punish them by bringing foreign invaders upon them. They suddenly realized the mistake they made and would call it to God. And God would raise up someone called a judge who would remove these foreign people and rule them for a good while. But it seemed like when that judge died, the cycle would repeat. And this went on for a while. But there were some notable judges that happened along the way. Obviously, I can't tell them all. There was the woman Deborah and the soldier Barak who cast out Sisera and his men. Although Deborah warned Barak that because he would not do it himself, he would fall to the hand of a woman. There was a certain woman named Jael who saw to it that Sisera was taken care of. There was also Gideon, who with only 300 men swarmed around a host of Midianites during the dead of night, broke open these pitchers containing torches, blew trumpets, and convinced them that a much larger troop than 300 was there, and set them fleeing. And then there was Samson, who was pretty much a hero of heroes, the kind of one that boys like to read about, he came during the time of the Philistines, and many Philistines died by his hand. And even in the end, when he was captured, he had what you call the last laugh by collapsing the entire temple, not only on himself, but 1,000 more Philistines. So these judges kept trying to steer Israel back, and they would kind of veer away again. But then we come to someone called Samuel. Samuel was special in that he was asked directly of God by his eventual mother, Hannah, who was barren. She was upset because her, unlike the other wife that her husband Elkanah had, could have no children. So she asked of this, and God did give her Samuel. But because God had answered her prayer and given it her, she knew the right thing would be to give Samuel back. So Samuel, upon reaching the age where he was weaned, went to the tabernacle and became an assistant unto the priest, especially the chief priest Eli. But when he was there, God eventually called out to him. God had not called out to Eli or had called out to anyone else in quite a while. Because of this, at a young age, people began to realize that Samuel would be a prophet and become one of the last great judges himself, if not, I should say, the last judge. And so, upon the failing of Eli and the Philistines' conquering of the ark, though since they were plagued, they had to bring it back, Samuel would become the next judge and assume the leadership. And he did well. But eventually he grows old. His sons were unethical and that they could be easily bribed and were not doing the righteous work that a judge should do. This is when the people called for a king. A king like all the other nations. Never mind the fact that the immortal and invisible God had been their king all along. And you might say that was the problem. The fact that he was invisible. They wanted someone they could see, someone to go out in front of the army and go charging into battle. Even though they rejected God as king, God gave them what they wanted. And a man of Benjamin, by the name of Saul, would become the first king. Unfortunately, Saul proved to be flawed. He did not realize that the sacrificing unto God was to be done by the priest, and as a king, he thought he should do something as well. So on one occasion, instead of waiting for Samuel to come to see the offering prepared, he offered the offering himself. And then when he was told to wipe out the Amalekites completely, all the way down to their animals, he saved the best to sacrifice unto God. But if you're going to sacrifice unto God something he told you to destroy, that is not acceptable. So for reasons like this, Saul was rejected. God said he would seek out someone else, a man after his own heart. This would be a young boy of the tribe of Judah whose name was David. The youngest of Jesse's children, he was the shepherd. He took care of the sheep. If a lion came, if a bear came, try to take the sheep, David would tackle it, get the sheep away from him, and strike it down. For a young age, he was very stout, very strong, very brave. And when Saul's mind began to be affected after he was rejected for being king, someone revealed to him that David was also a musician. He played the harp. He would write his own songs, which we know as the Psalms. And so for a while, David came to Saul to play the harp and cure him. But the thing was, God directed Samuel that David was to be anointed, for he was to be the next king. Now, when the Philistines once again invaded and came with a large giant champion by the name of Goliath, it was David, with only his shepherd instruments, who toppled him. He brought a great deliverance unto Israel, and a lot of people began to take notice of him. But this made Saul jealous, especially when the crowds would sing of the thousands he had slain and the 10,000s that David had slain. But Saul's son Jonathan understood David and made a friendship with him because he realized what a virtuous soul David was. And Jonathan sensed over time that it was only fair the kingdom go to this young man. And he, Jonathan himself, told David he would be perfectly happy being second in command. But this did not sit well with Saul. He sought many ways to kill David until David had to go out as an outlaw. And eventually, in another invasion of the Philistines, Saul would die in battle. But sadly, so would Jonathan. So the land was now in an unstable position of leadership. David, as an outlaw, had made a name for himself, especially among his own tribe of Judah. Saul's family raised up one Ish-bosheth to be the king of Israel. But because of the split in who was favored, there was more times of civil war. Until two men unjustly killed Ish-bosheth. It was not like he died in battle. Someone snuck into his house and killed him to try to get David's favor. But they ended up paying with their own life. This is not how it's supposed to happen. But one way or another, the anointing of David came about as it should, and the land was united. Now, we had spoken about how Abraham was given the promise of a land. David was given the promise that his seed would be the rulers over this land, over this kingdom. And David was startled by this promise, realizing God has spoken to my house a great while to come. He was grateful to receive this. But we got to realize, as much as David was a man after his own heart, he was human. He was going to do human mistakes. In a moment of lust, he took another man's wife by the name of Bathsheba. This brought turmoil to his house because, as a curse for committing adultery, he would have war from then on. Whether it's war within his family, whether it's war in the surrounding nations, it said the sword would never depart from his house. Now, the child he bore with Bathsheba, the first one died, but here's the interesting thing. Another of the children he had with Bathsheba had the name of Solomon. He was loved of God, and he would eventually become the next king. But some of the turmoil that happened. One of his sons attacked his half-sister. Absalom, that sister's brother, killed Amnon, the son who had made the attack, had to flee into exile, was not called back by David for a long time, burned with resentment. When he finally came back, he raised up a rebellion of his own. When that rebellion was put down, another man named Sheba tried to start a rebellion, and that had to be put down as well. These are just some of the troubles that happened. And then there was this unwise census that David made, trying to number the warriors of Israel and Judah. And as punishment, he put himself into the hands of God, who obsoleted those numbers with a massive plague that struck the land. But one interesting thing came of this. When the plague was stopped from coming into Jerusalem, God told him to go to a certain land in there and buy it. For on this land, sacrifices would be made to heal the people. And this land is the land in which a temple would be built. Not the tabernacle that had been a temporary structure going from place to place. This temple would be a more stable, a more permanent building. David himself would not build this temple, though he had thought of it many times before, because he had been a man of blood. There was too much blood on his hands to faithfully and justly build the temple. But his son would, his son Solomon. When David passed, Solomon came on board. God appeared to Solomon in a dream and he asked him what he should get. What can I give you? What gift can I give you? Solomon realized that to rule this people he needed an understanding heart, wisdom and knowledge. And that's what he asked for. God gave him that. And he proved to become one of the wisest men of that particular generation. And he saw to the building of this grand and glorious temple. But again, like David, Solomon was human. Solomon made mistakes. He fell in love with many foreign women. And it was a custom back then for marriages to happen between nations as political alliances. But he would also love these women. Be curious what these women did. These women worshipped certain gods. He was curious about the gods. He ended up worshipping them himself. It was just like what happened during the time of the judges. Because Solomon was unfaithful, his family would not retain the entire kingdom. There was a man by the name of Jeroboam who was approached by a prophet Abijah. who, taking his own robe and tearing it into 12 pieces, handed 10 to Jeroboam, saying, 10 of the tribes are yours now. Make a kingdom from them and follow God. Well, when Solomon passed and his son Rehoboam was brought up to become king, Jeroboam was called back because many people had grown resentful and restless under Solomon because of the many building projects that he did and the opulence of his court and having to feed everyone. He had taxed the people heavily. They wanted relief, and they wanted Jeroboam to be the representative to bring these concerns forth. Rehoboam, though, unwisely was harsh with them, telling them that anything that happened under Solomon was going to be far worse under his administration. My father chastised you with whips, but I'll chastise you with scorpions. That's a direct quote. So, as God had prophesied would happen, 10 of the tribes split and went with Jeroboam. So, at this point, we have two kingdoms. Jeroboam was in charge of Israel. God had told him, take care of these people and follow me. But Jeroboam was worried. The temple and the faith, the law of Moses, all of that was in Jerusalem on the other side of enemy lines. And if the people, he figured, went to Jerusalem for to worship, their heart would turn back towards the kingdom of Judah. They would come back and kill him and be reorganized. He wanted to keep the focus of Israel in Israel and not worry about what Judah was happening. Just like in the wilderness, once again the golden calves appeared, one in the north end of the kingdom, one in the south end. South one right next to the border of Judah, so anyone would be compelled to stop there and worship the calf instead of going on to Jerusalem to worship the true God. It wasn't enough that the golden calves were brought into it. Eventually, along the time, this man named Omri made peace with the king of Phoenicia. And for his son Ahab, he requested Jezebel to come and be Ahab's wife. And Jezebel brought with her the worship of a god called Baal. So the golden calf was not enough. Now we had this foreign god who was infamous of the time, further polluting Israel's mind when it comes to worship. Now there's a couple of noble prophets to talk about during this time. One by the name of Elijah rose up and prophesied that because of the coming of Baal, Israel was going to be left without rain for several years until God told him again. And Elijah would be a great enemy to Ahab, although he spoke with care concerning the nation. Ahab would kind of repent. He would kind of feel sorry about certain things. It was never a complete repentance. And eventually he would be killed in battle. Now Elijah, meanwhile, had a successor of his own by the name of Elisha, who continued to be a minister to Israel. For the few people that still sought to worship the one true God, he and the school of prophets he would set up would continue to direct people's ways. But eventually the story of the northern kingdom was just one of bloodshed and betrayal. There wasn't really a clear line from beginning to end that, for the most part, we'd see with the kingdom of Judah. This person reigns. Someone else comes along and kills him. He reigns, maybe his son reigns. Someone else comes along and kills him, but he immediately gets killed himself. This was what it was like all the way, pretty much until the end. Till finally the empire of Assyria came down upon them and conquered them. Israelites were carried away. Other foreigners that Assyrians captured would become and forced to live in the lands that Israel possessed. So, with a few Israelites that were not taken away, and the foreigners brought in, these are the people that become known as the Samaritans, and there was always a clash between them and the Jews, because the Samaritans would like to think that being of the land and knowing some of the things about the God of Israel, they could work with the Jews, and it didn't work that way. I think our readings in Nehemiah and Ezra point that out. They thought about this, but when they were turned down, they were nothing but trouble for Nehemiah and his time. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's take a look at Judah. Rehoboam and Abijam were not necessarily as faithful to God as they could have been, and so it was a rough start for the kingdom of Judah at first. Asa was better. He removed some of the idols. He even removed his mother from being queen because she worshipped idols. There was a son, Jehoshaphat, who was also faithful. But he made a problem. He really wanted to have some sort of tie with the northern kingdom. And unfortunately, this started with Ahab. So Israel, for a while, would have an influence on Judah. Jehoshaphat would eventually pass. His son Ahaziah would come up. And Ahaziah thought more along the kingdoms of Israel than the faith of Judah. It would work with Joram, king of Israel, in battles. And when Jehu rose up to punish Joram and end that Ahab's line, he killed Ahaziah as well. Now, Athaliah was Ahaziah's mother, and it was another arranged marriage because she was related to Jezebel. She took over the land of Judah by killing off what she thought was all the seed royal, except one by the name of Joash was hidden. At 7 years old, the high priest Jehoiada brought him out of hiding, made him king, and Athaliah was destroyed. Now Jehoiada, as long as he was alive, instructed young Joash in the way he should walk, and Joash did very well, except after Jehoiada died, his heart turned back toward idols again. He was killed by certain servants. His son Amaziah would become king and kill those which had killed him. And he understood the ways of God, but he didn't really do it with a perfect heart. With Uzziah, that followed, he did slightly better, except he made a mistake similar to Saul, and that he thought as a king he should be worshiping in the temple and burning incense. He was struck down with leprosy for that and removed, and his son Jotham became the administrator part of the time while Uzziah was alive, and then fully upon the death of Uzziah, his father. And he was faithful. Unfortunately, his faithfulness didn't necessarily extend to the people of the land because it said they still did corruptly. Then next up we have Ahaz, who does another turn face, another about face, falling back to idols again, greatly, desecrating the temple, going up to Damascus, seeing an idol for another god whose pattern he loves, so he comes down and builds one in his own temple. Hezekiah, his son, when he comes along, has to clean all of this up. He wants to return to God, so he removes the high places, breaks the images, and learns how to sacrifice and observe the Passover once again. Now, Assyria, of course, had pretty much disposed of Israel by this time, or were in the process of disposing of Israel, and they themselves tried to come down and take Judah as well. This was under one Sennacherib. And not only did Hezekiah have to deal with this, but he was sick unto death at the time. And when prayed to God, God extended his life by 15 years. And as for Assyria, they were struck by a plague. Sennacherib had to go back to his own land. Now, while God had cured Hezekiah, Hezekiah's heart was lifted up. And so he did an unwise decision. When ambassadors from Chaldean Babylon came, he felt boastful. He just felt like breaking about what he had and showed them his entire house. But he didn't realize that they had taken note of this. And Isaiah warned him because of his rashness. Those ambassadors of Chaldea and Babylon is going to come and take all of your treasures. And we could see the slide toward this happen upon the death of Hezekiah. Because Manasseh rose up. He ruled the longest of the kings of Judah, but he was the most wicked king. He went above and beyond when it comes to idols. And it says he shed innocent blood very much. Some people say he was responsible for killing Isaiah. I won't exactly say how, but I think some of you know the story. It's quite gruesome. Towards the end of his life, when he went to a brief captivity, he tried to make amends to return to the God of Israel. Upon his death, though, Amon, his son, once again went down the path of idolatry, but he was killed by the people of the land. And Josiah, his son, becomes king. And you notice that besides this little hiccup with Athaliah, there is a continued chain. Even while the bloodshed, the chain of Judah continues. So we come to young Josiah, who was properly instructed, and once again wanted to return to God. When in the repairing of the temple, for we know of what Ahaz had done to it, The book of the law was discovered and apparently had not been read in its entirety a long time. And understanding how much of the law had gone undone, this tore Josiah up. What can we do? When his men inquired of the prophet Huldah, he warned him that yes, because of everything, especially of what happened in the time of Manasseh, Judah was greatly corrupted and they were going to be conquered. But because Josiah wanted to fix this, it was not going to happen in his time. The best he could do was forestall the inevitable. And he did that. But he continued to purge the idolatry throughout his land and even go into the Israel territories to purge the idols from there. But when Pharaoh Necho went up to fight with Chaldean Babylon, he went out to battle against them and died. And Jehoahaz, his son, became king and did not do well. With this in mind, Judah became a staging ground between Egypt and Chaldea as they fought out their battles. Jehoahaz himself was taken into the land of Egypt, and Jehoiakim was raised up as king. And the prophet Jeremiah lived during this time. He begged, he pleaded, he commanded, he yelled, he shouted. He wanted to steer Israel back, and they weren't doing it. And so for the next three kings, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and Zedekiah, it all ended the same way, with Chaldean Babylon coming into the land and taking captives. And in the case of Zedekiah, who unwisely tried to rebel against it, this last captivity resulted in Jerusalem being destroyed, and not only Jerusalem, but the temple itself. And from there, there's a small remnant that fled to Egypt, but because they would not give up the idolatrous practices, when Nebuchadnezzar turned his attention to Egypt, they too would suffer. We are gradually getting towards the end, and I'm surprised that I'm getting this close to the end of my talk as well. Very little left. Let's take a look now at the time of captivity. And this time of captivity goes from not only Chaldean Babylon, but to the empire that would succeed it, the empire of Medo-Persia. There's a certain man by the name of Daniel who lived during the time of the first captivity. And he was taken by the Babylonians back to Babylon. And he would essentially, you might say, become an ambassador, although it was more like a hostage, to the Jews that remained because he would be instructed in the ways of the Chaldean. It was a brainwashing. I mean, Daniel was given a Chaldean name of Belteshazzar. His friend Hanani was given the Babylonian name of Shadrach. Mishael became Meshach, and Azariah became Abednego. The process was, make these Jews Chaldeans. But Daniel and his friends wouldn't. Whether there was a small matter of not wanting to eat unclean foods, or a great manner which nearly cost the three friends their life when they would not worship an image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up, they remained faithful unto their God. Changed their name, you could fill their minds with all sorts of knowledge, but they remained faithful. And Daniel was given some great visions of prophecy showing what was going to happen. The nations and empires that would rise up after Chaldea. And even ones that would stretch all the way to the time of the end when God would finally fulfill the prophets. And there was another prophet by the name of Ezekiel. He was shown visions again before Judah's final capture, blaguing and begging and pleading with him to change. But eventually it was showed to him in vision that God would remove his glory from Jerusalem when Nebuchadnezzar in that final invasion would come to destroy it. And that's how the temple was destroyed, because God would not keep his glory in such a corrupted land. But though Ezekiel had much to say to the nations around it, he also spoke of how Israel would return and be a strong nation once again. And furthermore, even though this temple is destroyed, his prophecy ended with a vision of an even greater temple, which would be built in that very same land. Now, during the time of Daniel, the Medo-Persians conquered Babylon. Darius the Mede took over. The other kings, like Ahasuerus, Artaxerxes. Especially the time of Ahasuerus, we turn our attention to a woman by the name of Esther, who, at the king's command, was among many women brought forward to choose a new queen to replace the rebellious Vashti. And Esther, for her beauty, for her kindness, for her wisdom, she became the queen. Providentially, she was put in place because the machinations of one Haman to destroy the Jews was thwarted by her efforts. Now, in the time of the king Cyrus, he made a proclamation, which, interestingly enough, another prophet by the name of Isaiah had called Cyrus by name through God to do this, that the Jews should be allowed to return to their land to make it a Persian province. Ezra the priest was one of the first people to go back, to bring the people with it, to build up a temple once again. It would not be like Solomon's temple. It would certainly not be like the temple that Ezekiel saw, but it would be something. Nehemiah came as well, wanted to rebuild the walls that were in disarray, wanted to shore up the defenses, wanted to protect the land and the temple from those that would destroy it. And especially because some old bad habits were returning, had to make strict reforms as well, which you heard about in last night's readings. Of this, pretty much, the Bible speaks. But there are times not recorded. And I could try to go over those moments as quickly as possible. With the passing of the Medo-Persian Empire, there was the Greek Empire, and especially the section of the Greeks belonging to the family of Antiochus, the Seleucids, tried to impose Greek religion on Judah. And due to a certain family called the Maccabees, the Jews were able, for an all too brief time, to get their own independence again. But this did not last. At the hands of one Pompey from the next empire of Rome, Jerusalem was captured. And now that was the last time, until recent times, that any of the children of Israel have had their own independence, have had their own nation. And so in preparation for the next talk to come, they are now a province of Rome, under the Roman yoke. So as we can see, it's 4,000 years. And so much of Israel's history comes from these 4,000 years. The giving of two parts of the covenant. The promise of a land and the promise of a kingship. There's a temporary provision for the children of Israel under the hand of Moses. A law given. A land conquered. A taste of things to come in the first kingdom of Israel set up. An understanding of how humanity could cause a kingdom to fall. But yet, God in his promises is determined to rebuild it again. And even when the prophets were prophesying of the fall that was to come, there's also a promise of regathering. And as the talks continue, we'll get more into that. But the stage is set for one, by the name of Jesus Christ, Yahshua the Messiah, the very Son of God, to come onto the stage. And the promise given unto Abraham, which said, "In thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed," was about to come true by what this man, his disciples, and all the other apostles were about to say and about to preach. Here then is where our study concludes, and I thank you for your time and attention.